Welcome to AI Unraveled, your daily briefing on the real-world business impact of AI. Today, we're unlocking the next trillion-dollar market, the AI-native bio-enterprise. The cost of sequencing a human genome has plummeted, but the massive challenge of interpretation remains the bottleneck in drug discovery. We're exploring how large AI models are moving from assisting diagnostics to actively designing novel drugs, creating de novo proteins, and building digital twins of patients to revolutionize clinical trials. This is the new R&D battleground. In this special episode, we're mapping the next decade. We ask the critical questions: what is the single most important hire an R&D department can make? Which AI capabilities, from small molecule prediction to large molecule discovery, yield the highest ROI? And how do we secure massive genomic data sets while avoiding model bias? But first, a crucial word from our sponsor. If your platform solves the challenge of getting secure, compliant AI into production at scale, you need to talk to the right people. AI Unraveled is the single destination for those CTOs, VPs of engineering, and MLOps heads. Find the link to secure your mid-roll spot in the show notes. Please remember to like and subscribe to AI Unraveled on Apple Podcasts. And let's unravel the future of personalized medicine.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're looking at, well, a huge paradox in modern medicine.
Right.
You've got drug development costs just soaring, almost impossibly high. Eroom's law,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. Costs up, success down. It's the reverse of Moore's law.
But then, on the other hand, we are just flooded, absolutely swimming in biological data from the genomics revolution.
It's a real bottleneck issue now. It used to be hard to get the data. I mean, the Human Genome Project, that cost, what, $500 million to $1 billion?
Incredible numbers back then.
And now, you can sequence a whole human genome for, like, maybe $500, give or take. So
right.
The cost of generating data has just plummeted. But the challenge has totally flipped. We're drowning in A's, C's, G's, T's, just raw data.
And the interpretation is the hard part now.
Exactly. We lack the ability to quickly, accurately turn that massive volume into usable science, actionable insights.
So our mission today is to really dive into how artificial intelligence isn't just, you know, helping out here and there. It's becoming the core, the central organizing principle, you could say.
The central nervous system, yeah, of the modern bioenterprise.
We're exploring the rise of the AI-native bioenterprise. We'll touch on how AI is designing brand new drugs.
Stuff that doesn't even exist in nature.
How it's changing clinical trials, the ethical angles like bias, and even how policy is kind of accidentally shaping where the research money goes.
It's a lot to unpack.
Okay, let's start with just how inefficient the old way of doing R&D really is. If you're managing that portfolio, the numbers are just, well, terrifying.
Oh, absolutely. You're looking at typically over a decade for one drug.
A decade.
And the cost averages out to something like $2.8 billion per drug. That makes it to market.
And most don't even get close, right?
That's the killer stat. 90%. 9 out of 10 drugs that enter human clinical trials fail. They just don't make it.
90% failure.
And that's after the initial discovery phase. If you go back even earlier, like screening molecules, you might test 10,000 possibilities. And maybe one or two out of that 10,000 actually become a viable drug candidate. The whole system is practically built on failure.
It's staggering. And then you contrast that, like you said, with the sequencing cost crash.
Yeah.
From $500 million down to $500, that's just...
It's a technological leap that makes Moore's Law look kind of slow, actually.
So the competitive edge shifts completely.
Totally. It's not about generating data anymore. Anyone can generate data relatively cheaply now. The real advantage, the economic moat, is in the interpretation.
The algorithm.
The proprietary algorithms, the specialized AI models, the curated knowledge bases you need to translate those raw sequences, the A's, C's, G's, T's, into actual targets, potential therapies, and, you know, eventually successful drugs.
So for anyone looking at that R&D budget, feeling that Eroom's law pressure, AI isn't just some future tech anymore.
Not at all. It's a risk management strategy right now, today.
A financial tool.
It's about trying desperately to improve those odds at every single step to make the whole process less of a lottery and more, well, predictable. So to bridge that interpretation gap, what researchers are doing now is fascinating. They're taking large language models, LLMs, you know, the tech behind things like ChatGPT.
Right, the ones that understand human language.
Exactly, and they're adapting them to understand the language of life, chemistry, biology.
It's still kind of mind-bending to think of chemistry as a language. How does that work? How do you represent molecules?
Well, for small molecules, they often use these text strings called SMILES. It's a way to write down the structure. And for proteins, it's the sequence of their amino acids, just long strings of letters.
Okay, so the AI reads these strings like sentences.
Sort of, yeah. But that's where the specialization becomes absolutely critical. You can't just take a general LLM off the shelf and say, invent a new drug.
It would work.
No, it would likely hallucinate something completely useless. Chemically impossible, maybe. Or something that just couldn't physically exist. It doesn't intrinsically know the rules, the grammar of chemistry or biology. Not yet.
So how do you teach it? Is it like force-feeding it textbooks? Or flashcards?
Flashcards is a pretty good analogy, actually. It's called instruction tuning.
Yeah.
You create massive data sets of prompt-response pairs. Like, the prompt might be a smile string for a known molecule, say, ethanol CCO, and the required response is its specific chemical properties, boiling point, solubility, things like that.
Okay.
You use specialized data sets, things like SmallInstruct, to train the AI on thousands, millions of these examples. You're essentially teaching it the underlying logic of chemistry and biology through examples.
But these LLMs are huge, computationally speaking. Retraining the whole thing sounds incredibly expensive, especially for specialized tasks.
It is prohibitively expensive, often, which leads to this really clever engineering trick called parameter-efficient fine-tuning, or PEE.
P-E-T.
Yeah. Instead of retraining all the billions of parameters in the original model, you freeze most of them. Keep them locked.
So you don't touch the bulk of the model.
Right. And you only train these small additional layers called adapter layers. They're tiny in comparison. There was this chemistry model, Lasmol.
Lasmol.
Yeah. It achieved really top-tier, state-of-the-art results by fine-tuning less than 1%, just 0.58% of its base model's parameter.
Less than 1%. Wow.
It makes creating these highly specialized scientific AIs much more feasible computationally and financially. It lowers the barrier significantly.
Okay, so once you have these specialized, fine-tuned models, the game changes from just analyzing data to actually inventing things.
Yeah.
Generative biology.
Exactly. We saw models like AlphaFold get really good at predicting how proteins fold, which was a huge step.
Right. Prediction was a big challenge for a while.
But the new frontier is de novo design, creating entirely new proteins from scratch.
Proteins that nature hasn't even made.
Precisely. With completely novel structures, new folds designed for specific functions, we're not limited by what evolution happened to come up with anymore.
Is this actually working in practice?
Oh.
Or is it still mostly theoretical?
Oh, it's working. It's moving fast. Generative AI tools, like one called Protein MPNN, they're now getting experimental success rates for protein folding up near 20%.
20% success for a brand new designed protein to actually fold correctly.
Yeah. That's high enough to make it a really impactful, repeatable process for discovering new potential drugs or tools. It's not just theory anymore.
Okay, let's shift gears to the clinical trials. That's always been the huge bottleneck, right? Expensive, slow.
The biggest bottleneck, arguably. Yeah. And that's where the idea of the patient digital twin comes in.
A digital twin, like a simulation of a patient.
Exactly. Think of it as a dynamic molecular avatar for an individual. It's built by integrating all sorts of data about their genomics, their electronic health records, maybe real-time data from wearables.
All synthesized into one model.
Right. The goal is to create a simulation that can predict with high accuracy how that specific person would respond to a specific treatment.
Okay, I can see how that's useful for planning treatments. But how does it help the trial process itself?
This is the really clever part, the synthetic control arm, or SCA.
Synthetic control, meaning not real patients.
Right. Traditionally, you need a group of patients getting a placebo or standard care to compare against the new drug. That's your control arm.
Sure. Standard practice. But costly and ethically, sometimes tricky if the new drug looks promising.
Exactly. The idea with SCAs is to use these highly accurate digital twins to create virtual control patients.
Wait, hold on. You're using simulated patients instead of real ones for the comparison group. How can regulators possibly accept that? Isn't there a huge risk the simulation isn't quite right?
That's the crucial question. And the regulators were, understandably, very skeptical at first. You need rigorous proof. But companies like Unlearn.ai, they've developed methods, like their twin RCTs.
Twin RCTs.
Yeah. Randomized controlled trials using these twins, they can supplement or, in some cases, partially replace the traditional placebo arm. And the key thing is, this approach has been qualified by the European Medicines Agency, the EMA.
The EA qualified it, so they accept the statistical validity.
They do. For certain uses in phase 2 and phase 3 trials, they've determined it maintains the necessary statistical rigor, which is huge because it means fewer real patients need to be on placebo and trials can potentially be faster and cheaper.
Okay, that is a potential game changer.
Yeah.
Is there a real-world example of AI driving drug development this way?
Yes, definitely. A really prominent one is Rentacertib. It's a drug candidate from a company called Insilico Medicine.
Rentacertib. What's special about it?
It was the first drug candidate that was basically fully generated using an end-to-end AI platform to make it into phase 2 clinical trials.
Fully AI generated from start to phase 2.
Yeah. For a lung condition called idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, and the timeline is what's really striking.
How fast?
The whole process, from finding the initial biological target to nominating the final preclinical drug candidate, took about 18 months.
18 months compared to?
Traditionally, that same process takes, on average, maybe 6 years, sometimes much longer.
Wow. That's dramatic compression.
It is. And there's early data suggesting these AI-designed molecules might even be performing better in early trials. Phase I success rates historically are maybe 40 to 65%.
Okay.
Some reports suggest the AI-designed ones are hitting 80, maybe even 90% success in phase I. So potentially faster, smarter, and maybe even safer in those early stages.
Okay, so the science is accelerating like crazy. But if you're building this AI-driven bio-enterprise, you have to build it on trust.
Right.
Let's talk security. Genomic data is incredibly sensitive.
Probably the most sensitive personal information there is. And yet, for the research to work, especially the AI training, you need to pool massive amounts of it. It's a huge challenge.
The genomic Fort Knox problem.
Yeah.
How do you keep it secure but still usable for large-scale analysis?
We're relying on some pretty advanced privacy-preserving technologies, or PPTs. One of the most promising is homomorphic encryption, HE.
Homomorphic?
Oh.
What does that do?
Okay, think of it like this. You put your sensitive genomic data inside a locked digital envelope. You send that sealed envelope to a cloud server.
Okay.
The server can then perform complex calculations, run analysis, train models on the data inside the envelope without ever unlocking or opening it, without ever seeing the raw, unencrypted data.
Seriously? It computes unencrypted data?
Yes. The results come back, you unlock them with your key, but the server doing the work never saw the plain text DNA sequence or the patient's identity.
That sounds like magic. That's brilliant for individual privacy.
It is. And then there's another technique for when different organizations, say two hospitals, need to collaborate. Maybe they want to see if they have patients with a similar rare mutation, but neither wants to reveal their entire patient list to the other.
Right. They need to compute something jointly without sharing raw data.
Exactly. That's where secure multi-party computation, or SMPC, comes in. It allows them to get the combined answer, like how many patients match across both data sets without either side ever exposing their private inputs to the other.
Okay, so the tech exists to secure the data. But what about the results the AI gives back? Are they always fair? Let's talk bias, the ghost in the machine.
Yeah, this is a massive, massive issue. AI models are unfortunately very good at learning and even amplifying the biases already present in the data they're trained on.
And the data in genomics has known biases.
Huge biases. The vast majority of the foundational genetic studies, the big genome-wide association studies, or GWS, have overwhelmingly used data from people of European ancestry.
What kind of numbers are we talking?
Estimates vary slightly, but it's often cited as somewhere between 81 and 86% of the data coming from individuals of European descent.
86%. So what happens when you train an AI primarily on that data?
The consequence is pretty clear and worrying. The AI models tend to be less accurate, less effective for predicting health outcomes or drug responses in underrepresented populations.
So personalized medicine might not be truly personalized for everyone.
That's the risk. It could lead to misdiagnosis, ineffective treatments, and basically create this digital health inequity, where the cutting-edge medicine works best only for the group whose data dominated the training set. Addressing this data diversity is critical, urgently needed.
Okay, connecting ethics to economics now. We talked about the high upfront cost of personalized medicine, the sequencing, the advanced diagnostics. How do you justify that spending to, say, insurance companies or governments?
You frame it as a strategic investment, almost like buying insurance against future waste.
How so?
By identifying upfront which patients will actually benefit from a specific, often expensive drug, you avoid spending money on treatments that simply won't work for them. That cuts down on wasteful spending.
Yeah, and side effects too, presumably.
Exactly. Fewer adverse events means lower costs associated with managing those events. Some studies suggest targeted approaches could cut overall treatment costs by 30 or even 40% in the long run. The initial investment pays off through greater efficiency down the line.
Right. But now let's look at a policy that seems to be pushing things in a very specific direction, maybe not based purely on science. The U.S. Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA.
Ah, yes, the IRA. It's had a huge and arguably distorting impact on R&D investment decisions, specifically because of how it treats small molecules versus large molecules.
Oh, 'cause the difference it created.
It's often called the pill penalty. Under the IRA, traditional small molecule drugs think typical pills become eligible for Medicare price negotiation after just 9 years on the market.
9 years, okay.
But larger molecule drugs, biologics, often injectables, they get 13 years before facing negotiation.
13 versus 9. That's a 4-year difference in guaranteed market exclusivity, effectively.
A massive difference. That 4-year gap represents potentially billions of dollars in revenue needed to recoup the huge R&D costs, especially for small molecules, which often have broader initial uses.
And how did the investment market react to that difference?
Instantly and dramatically. Venture capital funding, particularly for early stage R&D focused on small molecules, reportedly plummeted, some estimates say by as much as 70%.
70% drop, just because of that policy change.
It seems so.
Mm-hmm.
The financial incentive shifted sharply towards biologics, purely because of that longer exclusivity window granted by legislation, not necessarily because biologics are always scientifically superior for every condition. It's actively steering innovation based on policy, not just science. So looking ahead, for any organization wanting to thrive, wanting to really be an AI-native bioenterprise, AI can't just be a side project or a single department.
It needs to be fundamental.
It has to be treated as a first principle, woven into everything. That means you need leadership that actually understands AI, or is at least AI literate. You need a culture that treats data as its most valuable asset. And you need infrastructure built for speed and agility.
But the sources we looked at really emphasized that the single most critical investment isn't tech, it's people. Specifically, one key role.
Absolutely. The crucial foundational hire is what's being called the interdisciplinary bio-AI data scientist.
Okay, to unpack that title, what do they do?
It's a hybrid role. This person needs to understand the biology. They're part computational biologist, part bioinformatician, but they also need the hardcore machine learning and data engineering skills, part ML engineer.
So they bridge the gap between the lab bench and the computer.
Exactly. They act as the human API, translating complex biological questions from the scientists into problems that machines can actually understand and work on. And critically, they're responsible for data quality.
Making sure the data going into the AI is good.
And not just good, but fair. That's an acronym. Findable, accessible, interoperable, and reusable. This person champions those principles. Without that translation and quality control role, even the fanciest AI tools are basically useless. Garbage in, garbage out.
So if you're leading a team, or maybe an executive trying to build this capability, what's the practical plan for, say, the first year? Where do you start? It sounds like you shouldn't just jump to the fancy generative models immediately.
No, definitely not. You need to do the foundational work first, the less glamorous stuff. It's absolutely essential.
Like what? Step one?
Step one, do a really thorough data audit. You need to map out where all your current data lives, which silos it's trapped in. Just understand what you have and where it is.
Okay, map the territory then.
Step two, appoint clear data governance leadership. Someone needs to be responsible and accountable for data quality, standards, and access.
Makes sense. Ownership.
Step three, you have to invest in a unified data platform, a central place to bring data together, clean it, standardize it, make it ready for AI.
Get it out of the silos.
Right. And step four, and this is key for building momentum and proving value, launch a foundational pilot project.
Not something overly ambitious?
No, something manageable. But use that pilot specifically as the vehicle to build your organization's first truly fair data set. Go through the whole process, enforce the data hygiene, learn the best practices internally. That pilot builds the foundation and demonstrates the value of doing it right. Hashtag, tag, outro. So we've seen how this AI-native approach can radically compress those R&D timelines we talked about.
From years down to months.
How it enables the actual invention of novel biology through generative design, not just prediction, and how it really forces us to build stronger ethical and data security foundations using these powerful new privacy tools.
But we end on a slightly uneasy note.
Yeah.
Connecting the internal science back to the external policy landscape.
Yeah.
That financial incentive, driven by the IRA, to strongly favor developing large molecule biologics over small molecules.
Right. An incentive based on negotiation timelines, not necessarily scientific need or opportunity.
So the provocative question we're left with is this. Does that policy-driven bias favoring biologics, because they get 13 years before price talks versus 9 for small molecules, does that risk creating a serious innovation gap down the road?
Specifically in areas where small molecules might actually be the better or maybe even the only therapeutic option, we're thinking about things like, say, most neurological disorders, conditions where drugs need to cross the blood-brain barrier.
Which is something small molecules are generally much better at doing than large biologics.
Exactly. So, is a policy designed to control costs today, potentially shutting down promising research avenues for treating incredibly difficult diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, or others tomorrow, simply because the optimal type of molecule falls on the wrong side of a legislative timeline?
That's a really critical question for the future. Whether that policy nudge, however well-intentioned, might inadvertently block pathways to major breakthroughs. Definitely something for you to think about as this whole field keeps changing at lightning speed.
Thanks for diving deep with us today.
We'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.
That wraps up our special episode on the AI-native bio enterprise. The key insight is that AI has compressed the R&D lifecycle from years into months. The future of personalized medicine isn't about if you adopt AI, but how you implement a secure and governed AI-native workflow, from fine-tuning LLMs for chemical structures to managing the ethical challenges of genetic data security. Before we sign off, a quick note on a high-value career opportunity in this space. We have a listing for a medicine tutor, full-time, paying $90K, $200K per year, which is a critical role in bridging the gap between clinical knowledge and AI systems. You can find the link to apply in the show notes. And if you are running an AI infrastructure company, you know that the complexity of securing massive genomic data sets requires enterprise-grade solutions. This is where you need to speak directly to the buyers. Stop marketing to the general public. Talk to enterprise AI builders. We have reserved a limited number of mid-roll ad spots for companies focused on high-stakes, governed AI infrastructure. This is a direct line to your most valuable buyers, the CTOs and VPs of engineering building these bio enterprises. Don't wait. Secure your mid-roll spot immediately. The link is in the show notes. If this deep dive helps you map your strategic R&D plan, please take a moment right now and like and subscribe to AI Unraveled on Apple Podcasts. Thank you for tuning in. We'll be back tomorrow to unravel the next chapter in AI.